Good afternoon. My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Rockefeller, Senator Collins, our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this program where we hope to take a close look at what a lot of folks see as the centerpiece of the insurance market reforms in the new health reform law, and that is the state-based exchanges or marketplaces where individuals and small businesses can buy health coverage. The idea, as most of you know, behind these exchanges is for them to promote competition among insurers based on value, to minimize administrative costs, and to offer a wider array of choices for buyers. And they have to be up and running by the first part of 2014. Now, that may seem like a long way off, but if those goals are going to be achieved, there's going to be a lot of hard work, a lot of tough choices to be made by both federal and state officials between now and then. Now, there are a few examples of exchanges that already exist, particularly in Utah and in Massachusetts, and there may be some lessons to be learned by looking at the experiences in those states. Now, today we're going to hear from both federal and state officials who are grappling with these issues and get the perspective also of small business and consumer viewpoints about how to best assure that exchanges actually move us toward these goals of broadening coverage, improving quality, holding down costs. We're pleased to have as a partner in today's program the Commonwealth Fund, most of you know, a philanthropy based both in New York City and with a presence in Washington that has been an extremely active player in the policy debate over the last several years, trying to explain various policy options to policymakers. And I should say that few policy experts know more about private insurance and how it operates than my co-moderator today, the Vice President of Commonwealth for Affordable Health Insurance, Sarah Collins. And Sarah, let me turn to you at this point.
Thank you very much, Ed. I'm going to make just a few brief comments about the provisions in the Affordable Care Act, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, regarding the exchanges. In terms of timing, I'll just go. In terms of timing, what happens next, and Joel Argo will certainly provide a lot more detail on this, but HHS will begin to award grants to states beginning next year so that states can start planning and implementing their insurance exchanges. Over the next 3 years, states that elect to do so will start adopting legislation and begin implementation. Obviously, we've seen California moving ahead already on this with the governor signing their legislation into law earlier this month. The exchanges will play a critical role in covering the 32 million people who are projected to gain coverage under the new reform law. An estimated 16 million people are projected to become covered under Medicaid, and an additional 16 million people will gain coverage through the exchanges or employer-based plans. Health plans sold through the exchanges will include a federally defined essential benefit package and will vary by cost-sharing responsibility, ranging from higher cost-sharing in the bronze plans to gradually lower cost-sharing in the silver, gold, and platinum plans. People with incomes up to 400% of poverty who don't have employer-based coverage or Medicaid will be eligible for sliding scale tax credits that will cap their premium costs from 2% of income up to 9.5% of income. Cost-sharing credits and limits on out-of-pocket costs, also on a sliding scale, will reduce out-of-pocket exposure for low- and moderate-income families. Those newly covered in the exchanges are estimated to be joined by about 8 million people that will shift from individual and employer-based plans. And small firms are projected to bring about 5 million workers and their families into the exchanges by 2019. In terms of the law's key provisions on the exchanges, each state must establish an individual and small group exchange, but they can actually merge those two. HHS will operate exchanges in states that elect not to operate their own exchanges. The new market reforms, such as no underwriting on the basis of health in the new healthcare law, will be basically the same inside and outside, at least the exchanges, at least for the non-grandfathered plans. And the essential benefit standard also has to be provided both inside and outside. Plans sold through the exchanges will be known as qualified health plans and will be certified by the exchanges. Qualified health plans, or QHPs, must sell plans at the silver and gold levels at least. Plans selling outside the exchanges do not face that requirement. Small businesses of 50 to 100 employees and 100 by 2016 can offer health plans to their employees through the exchanges, and states can open the exchanges to employers with 100 or more workers in 2017. Premium and cost-sharing credits and the small employer tax credits starting in 2014 can only be used for plans purchased through the exchanges. HHS will establish a risk adjustment mechanism and other transitional provisions that will help compensate insurance carriers that are participating in the exchanges who have higher than average risks or a sicker than average population. The implementation of exchanges lies primarily with the states, but HHS will issue regulation and set standards for operation of the exchanges. The federal government has several responsibilities on the exchanges. Those include establishing certification criteria and marketing requirements for the QHPs, defining the essential benefit package, ensuring that QHPs are accredited on clinical quality and other measures, developing a rating system that will rate QHPs within each benefit level on relative quality and price, determine the initial open and special enrollment periods. After HHS sets standards for the exchanges, states can adopt the federal standard into their own laws or adopt similar standards that HHS deems equivalent. The agency will award grants for states for planning and establishing the exchanges, and after that, exchanges must be self-sufficient. Once the exchange is operational, state responsibilities include certifying the qualified health plans, rating the plans, reviewing premium increases and deciding whether to accept plans into the exchanges, informing individuals of their eligibility for Medicaid and CHIP, and coordinating that eligibility with the subsidized premiums, awarding grants to navigators to educate the public about qualified health plans, and subsidies, and also just overall facilitating enrollment. While this seems, these lists of provisions in the law and the responsibilities for the federal government and for states feels like a grocery list, there are actually, behind each item, there's a whole set of questions regarding how these will be done and carried out and implemented. In addition, states are going to have considerable flexibility in terms of in designing their exchanges that will have implications for plan participation, may lead to increased lower premiums over time and improvements in healthcare quality, and we're going to hear a lot more about that from the panelists today. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. Setting the stage very nicely for quite a distinguished panel. Let me just do a little bit of logistical grunt work here, if I can. There'll be a webcast of today's briefing available on Monday, thanks to our friends at the Kaiser Family Foundation at kff.org. A couple of days after that, you'll see a transcript on the Alliance website, allhealth.org. There are the materials that you have in front of you on both of those websites associated with this briefing. There are microphones in the front and back at the point when we get to the Q&A session. There's a green card you can use to write a question out, and we'll bring it forward. And there's the ever-popular blue evaluation form, which we hope you will fill out and to help us improve these programs as we go along. We do have a really terrific panel, and I will jump right in to give them far briefer introductions than they deserve, but we'll assume you're going to look at the biographical information that supplements that in your packets. I'm going to lead off today with Joel Ario, the Deputy Director of the Office of Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight. Is it Is there an acronym there, or is it just a collection of letters?
OSIO.
OSIO.
I didn't make it up. Don't blame me.
I want to say gozaimashita after that. Joel's in charge of the Office of Insurance Exchanges, whose job it is to make sure that there are well-functioning exchanges in every state and D.C. by January of 2014. Now, the last time Mr. Ario spoke at an Alliance Commonwealth event, which was just a few weeks ago, he was the insurance commissioner in Pennsylvania, and he was heading up efforts by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners to offer recommendations to HHS on exchanges. So now he's in a position to take his own advice, and maybe we'll find out the extent to which he's going to do that. Joel, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. And thank you, Ed. Good to be here today. As Ed said, the last time I spoke at an Alliance event, I was a co-panelist with Tim Jost, and we had a lively exchange on Capitol Hill, and at that time I did have a lot of opinions. I kind of channeled my governor, Ed Rendell. I had an opinion on everything, and they were usually pretty provocative opinions at that. I'm doing a lot more listening in the last 8 weeks since I took this job, and I think that's as it should be. And so the provocative things for today are with my buddy Mike McGrath over here, who now chairs the committee at the NAIC. I thought that I'd talk about a couple things today. One is the states, what's happening in the states, because as Sarah said, the initiative lies with the states on the exchanges. If the states choose to put up an exchange, they have the first right to do that, subject to our federal standards, and only where the state either decides not to do it or doesn't meet the federal standards will the federal government step in. So I've spent a lot of time with the states. I'll talk about that briefly. And then the second thing is I'll talk some about where we are in terms of those federal standards and guidance to the states, the federal framework under which the states will operate. Starting with the states, though, the very first month I was on the job in September, I was on an East Coast meeting of the National Governors Association and a West Coast meeting of the National Governors Association, and I think all but one state were represented in one of those two locations. They all brought teams of people from their insurance departments, people from their Medicaid offices, people from governor's offices, departments of health, and we had very lively exchanges, and it became clear to me immediately, to the extent it wasn't already, that there was a lot of interest at the state level in these exchanges, and that it was very focused and very specific to the fact that the state markets are broken. Every state that was there had the same basic view, which is our individual and small group markets don't work that well. Look at the large group market, maybe not as many problems, but in those individual and small group markets where the exchanges are targeted, people had a recognition that there was a lot of upside here, a lot of opportunity under the federal law, and they were there to roll up their sleeves and go to work on it, and we had a lot of very specific back and forth dialogue on a lot of different issues, and I've continued to learn from the states as we've moved through the last couple months. Just this week, I was down at the NAIC meeting in Florida. We put up what we called office hours, an invitation to states to come talk to us about what their plans were at the current time, kind of advancing from where they were even a month ago. 22 states signed up in just a couple days that we had for people to sign up, and we had another series of kind of lively discussions. The states aren't all in the same place on this, but everybody has the same kind of basic message that there's real opportunity here to be taken up, and it's kind of like I'm a kind of political junkie, so I go home at night and I turn on the TV and I see MSNBC spin on something, and I want to see Fox's spin, and then I got to turn to CNN and see their spin as well. And most of the healthcare news that you see on those three cable networks, anyway, is pretty ideological, and it's kind of us versus them, and one side or the other. And reminds me of what someone once said about lawyers. I'm not sure why two distortions are the way to get to the truth, but that seems to be what you oftentimes see there. But that's not what I see when I'm out talking to the states. I see people, it's hard to see who's from a red state or a blue state. You just see people who are working in their marketplaces trying to put things together. And then in addition to those kind of broad meetings, and I would say states are across a very broad spectrum, some states are just kind of getting their toes in the water and thinking about how to put up an exchange, but there are a number of states that are much further along than that. I spent a lot of time with the Massachusetts people a week ago, kind of talking through where they are with their exchange, and as people know, that exchange continues to be, and the whole health reform really continues to be massively popular in the state of Massachusetts. I think the lowest it's ever gone in the polls is 59%, and it's somewhere around 75% popularity now, and their exchange continues to work very well in the individual market. They have some challenges in the small group market. They're trying some new strategies. I think that's an area that we're continuing to look at carefully, too. How do you make this exchange concept work in the small business marketplace as well as you make it work in the individual market? We saw earlier this month that Governor Schwarzenegger, another Republican governor, just like Mitt Romney in Massachusetts, signed a strong exchange bill out there, similar to the Massachusetts law in that it has a kind of active purchaser exchange that is going to operate more like a large employer in the sense that it's out negotiating with the plans in the marketplace. The insurers might prefer a different kind of model, but those are the models those two states have chosen. We've been in dialogue with a third state, Utah, that's cited often for its exchange. It's in an earlier stage of development there. They've taken a look at the federal law, and they've agreed with us on 2 points. One, that the kind of basic model they have, which is more of an open marketplace type of exchange, that sort of any willing insurer, you could call it, take all insurers that meet minimum qualifications in to the exchange, that model is workable under the federal law, is their view, and that the rest of the requirements under the federal law are things that they have to add to their exchange. They wouldn't qualify today as an exchange, but they think those are workable. They tell me every time we talk that as long as you're reasonable in how you interpret the requirements of the law and regulation, that they can put up an exchange that will meet those federal standards, and they're working towards that. You can go to the Oregon website and read about the Oregon exchange and the fact that it was authorized by legislation before the federal law passed, and they're fairly far ahead of the game and kind of very specific recommendations they have on how the governance structure of the exchange should work. They recommend a kind of quasi-public authority, which seems to be what most states are talking about now as an authority structure for the exchange. And I could go on and list a number of other states that are all moving forward in one form or another on these exchanges. And so I think the federal law got it right, that to give the states the initiative. The country is pretty broad, pretty varied, and the idea that there would be sort of different kinds of exchanges in different parts of the country, all under some general federal framework, I think was a good move by the Congress. And so far what I've seen would suggest that the states are going to step up to that task, and that the kind of political noise you see at the broader level on the cable shows and so forth is not directly impacting the way in which the work is proceeding in the states these days. But, of course, all the states, in addition to saying, give us a lot of room, give us a lot of flexibility, also have their notions of where we need to help them. And so there is a second part to the task here, and that's why I still will have a day job for a while, trying to figure out what those federal basic requirements are, working with a broad range of different interests and federal partners and so forth, trying to put together that scheme. And there's three basic pieces of that now that I just briefly touch on here. First is the planning grants, 48 states, and this would be another symbol of where we are with the states. We went out, and before I got there in August, with an opportunity for states to get planning grants from us of up to $1 million to plan an exchange. Some people thought, well, maybe only half the states or something will take that if you looked at the way it was talked about in some of the states. In fact, 48 of the 50 states plus the District of Columbia put in applications, and almost all of them robust applications for the whole $1 million. And I don't want to be gaga over, you know, we're offering them $1 million. It's not the hardest thing to say yes to. But still, they had to put together a detailed proposal, and we're working now with those 48 states. The only two that didn't were Minnesota and Alaska. And if you look at what's happening in Minnesota, their legislature probably has as active a group of stakeholders working on an exchange as any one of the 48 states that did apply. So we really got pretty much universal participation there, and now we have these planning grants, and we have staff specifically dedicated to working with each of those states. Every state has its own plan, and we're working through those plans with the states. We have another call with them Monday to kind of take the next steps of that planning process, and then those grants, those state planning grants, will turn into establishment grants in the spring of this year, and then each state will have its own track to move forward on its own plan for an exchange. And the law, if you look at it carefully, says basically that the federal government provides the necessary money for states to put up a state-based exchange as long as they're meeting the secretary's benchmark. So always going to be a federal role here, but basically the federal government pays for them until 2014, until 2015, and then they need to be self-funded at the state level. So that's one track we're working on through the planning grants, turns into establishment grants in the states next year, and continues on through the process until the exchanges are up and running in 2014. Second track that we're working on is the regulatory framework, and there we said our goal is to produce some general guidance, you know, probably in the form of a fairly short overview of what would be a foreshadowing of what we would do in rulemaking in 2011, and that will touch on some of the major issues that we think are important to get done early on in this process. And number one on that list is put up the exchange itself in the sense of a governance structure. The states that have exchanges now, Massachusetts and California, have a quasi-public authority with a governance structure. A lot of time and energy went into thinking about who's on those boards, how do you make them accountable, how do you avoid conflicts of interest, et cetera, et cetera. All of those sorts of issues the states need to take on, we think, in the next year. Mike, I think, is going to talk about the NAIC model law. It sort of highlights that issue and tells the states they have different options to take in setting up that governance structure. But we really think when you think about the timeline, 2014 is here much faster than most people think. It certainly seems like a close day to me. If you don't get that governance structure created in 2011, so those can start to be a business plan and so forth, you're probably going to have some challenges. So that's the first step, and there'll be some other guidance kind of foreshadowing the rules. We will produce rules probably in two series of rules in 2011, one in the spring, one in the fall on some of the more complicated issues. And then the final thing I'll say, and I'm past my time, so I'll be very brief on this, is that if there's one thing the states say don't give us so much flexibility on, it's the IT component of this. They all say don't make us reinvent the wheel 50 times. There's no reason for all of us to create a complicated new IT system to handle the front end of the website that every state will have as part of its exchange. And so we've taken that message to heart. There's a lot of work going on the federal front end in terms of the IRS income sort issue, the Social Security numbers, and how people will be able to kind of quickly get themselves situated towards Medicaid, towards the exchange, or maybe just to buy insurance through the exchange without a subsidy. Then there's a state piece where the states do vary, and that message of don't make us reinvent the wheel, we're taking to heart, and we're looking, and I hope this happens even sooner than our guidance, some kind of opportunity for states to look at different kinds of prototypes for those exchanges. And if we have a couple different kinds of prototypes, maybe most of the states can work with one or a mixture of those prototypes, and that will prevent, you know, 50 different reinventions of the wheel. So that kind of IT guidance, I think, is certainly right on the top of our list, top of my list, and we hope to produce that fairly soon. And that kind of is the framework of what will then take us into 2011. I could just touch the surface of what we're doing with that, but I'm interested to hear the rest of the panelists and have another lively exchange like we did back in August. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Joel. Next, we're pleased to welcome back Professor Timothy Jost, who's on the faculty at Washington Lee Law School. He has literally written the book on health law for American law schools. It's called Health Law. He's also the author of two very helpful papers on exchanges. You have the executive summaries and blog posts about both of those in your packets, and links on that list of materials to the full text of both. He's also a consumer representative to the NAIC that we've been hearing so much about already. So we're very pleased to have you back. Tim?
Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank Ed and the Alliance for inviting me today, and Sarah and the Commonwealth Fund for paying for all my work in this area. And it's a privilege to be on the panel with Joel and Mike, whom I know well from the NAIC, and from Terry, who taught me everything I know about shop exchanges. So I'll get through this quickly. I'd like to just quickly summarize the recommendations from my latest paper, which was called something like 8 Difficult Issues with respect to health insurance exchanges. I tried to really drill down into some of the really difficult issues that we're facing with implementing exchanges, and I'd like to very quickly talk about those. First, governance. I recommend that the exchange should be in an independent state agency, which should generally be subject to state administrative law requirements, except in contracting requirements and civil service requirements, except insofar as it makes good sense to vary some of those, which is basically the approach that I think that at least California and Massachusetts have taken. Exchanges could also be contracted out to nonprofit organizations. I think you get into some pretty complicated questions of with respect to other state and federal laws if you do that, and I think states should go there very cautiously. On the other hand, states do have the authority to contract out specific functions, and many of those functions are functions that are readily available in the private sector. I get the feeling already that there's going to be a lot of competition for providing some services to exchanges, and I think probably a number of services probably should be contracted out by the exchanges to the private sector, where there is a competitive market available and where an essential governmental function is not involved. Secondly, I think the biggest problem that has historically faced exchanges, and I believe this will continue to be true, is adverse selection. States should carefully regulate the market outside the exchange so that there are no advantages really to going outside the exchange rather than staying inside the exchange. And also, we need careful regulation to make sure that there is not adverse selection within the exchange, that some plans don't end up with all the high-risk individuals and others with the cream of the crop.
Tim, excuse me just a second. Can the folks in the back hear? Okay, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry if I'm too quiet. And so the risk adjustment is going to play a very important role here, but the market rules are going to be very important as well. And that's something states need to pay careful attention to. And I also have some real concerns in states that decide not to do an exchange as to how the federal government, which will be running the exchange, will be able to protect itself against adverse selection from the outside market. The third issue, well, actually, this is really part of the same issue that I discuss in more length there, is the problem once the exchange or if the state moves the exchange to the large group market, the problems that additional problems that will be faced there for adverse selection. And one real problem, I think, comes from self-insured plans where states can't regulate self-insured plans under ERISA. There's the possibility of a company remaining self-insured until its experience deteriorates to the point where premiums are cheaper in the exchange and then simply moving to the exchange. And there are also, we're seeing increasingly the formation of what I would call faux self-insured plans where you have very, very small plans, 10 members or fewer, that have stop-loss insurance, consider themselves to be self-insured, and again can stay out of state regulation until it becomes to their advantage to go into the exchanges. And some way is going to, I think, Department of Labor and Treasury need to think more carefully about what a self-insured plan really is, but also if the exchanges do go beyond 100, I think they'll have to come up with some way of protecting themselves against those plans. Fourth, is the issue of how to serve small employers, and I think Terry's going to tell us a lot about that. I think there's a couple of ways of reading the bill. One is that it may be possible for employers to simply purchase a group policy from the exchange, but the primary model that the statute seems to envision is a plan where the employer picks the tier and the employee picks the plan. That is going to be very difficult to administer since employees will be probably underwritten on age basis, tobacco use, maybe wellness. So you have and each of them can pick a different insurer. And so you have the possibility of employers having to write separate checks to dozens of different insurers at different amounts. That isn't going to work. So some method needs to be found to aggregate, to consolidate the bills, and that will be an essential service of the exchanges to small employers. And I think there's a couple of possibilities here. Employees should be able to pay a fixed percentage of premium for a specified level of coverage. or possibly employees should be able to pay a lump sum in addition to the employer contribution. There's probably different ways you can work this, but they're not unlimited. Once we move to age rating, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act is going to limit the ways in which employers can pay for coverage. Next issue is this question of active versus passive purchaser. And I think the direction that plans go with that, that exchanges go with that, is going to depend on their own market. Different states may take different options. But I'm hoping that states, as Massachusetts and California have done, take a very serious look at the exchange playing an active role in the market. It is going to have a regulatory role because it does have to certify that plans comply with the basic requirements for being qualified health plans, and it does, under the statute, have to look at premiums. But beyond that, I think we've seen this year that HHS and CMS has had some success in negotiating with Medicare Advantage plans. Massachusetts negotiates with plans, and I think there might be some value in many states, at least, for the exchange taking a somewhat active role in making sure that its consumers receive value. Moving on to the next issue, the exchange is going to provide two different kinds of information. It's going to provide descriptive information and it's going to provide evaluative information. The descriptive information is pretty well described in the statute. The evaluative information is going to be ratings and patient satisfaction surveys, and I think a lot of thought needs to go into how to make those really useful to consumers. And in particular, I think that the exchange should focus on satisfaction by consumers who actually use their insurance product, people with chronic diseases, people with financial problems related to health care, and not just everybody who has an insurance policy but never uses it. With respect, I think maybe the most difficult problem that the exchanges face is the interface with Medicaid and the interface between the state exchange and the federal government with respect to processing applications for the premium tax credits and cost reduction subsidies. Statute is very complicated. Parts of it, frankly, don't make a lot of sense. I tried to work through it with some help from some people at Center for Budget Policy Priorities and at Georgetown, trying to understand exactly how this is going to work. But it's going to take a lot to make it work. And there the IT is going to be very important, and I don't know anything about IT. Finally, I think if we flop there, the exchange is going to be a miserable failure. If people apply for tax credits and don't hear for weeks and then things get screwed up and they have to come in somewhere and provide lots of documents, that's going to be a disaster. It has to function seamlessly. It has to function efficiently. It has to function transparently. It has to function with great privacy and confidentiality protections. And I'm sure Joel can fix that. Anyway, that's going to be a big issue. And then finally, exchanges need to find some way to lower administrative costs. Exchanges have to come up with a way of funding themselves. I think that one thing to look at there is assessing a tax against all the insurers in the market to help pay for the exchange, because the exchange is going to undoubtedly end up with the more problematic cases, and that's going to be a benefit to everybody in the market. And then finally, there's the issue of agents and brokers commissions, and I guess I'm out of time. That's a very, very important issue. Agents and brokers do provide useful services. The statute contemplates that they will continue to play a role. But the statute also contemplates, I believe, that people will be able to buy insurance directly, and also that they will be able to receive some forms of assistance from navigators. So all of that's going to have to be worked out. Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks very much, Jim. We're going to turn next to Michael McGrath. As Joel said, he's in charge of the insurance department in Illinois. Among other duties, he's the head of the state's existing high-risk pool. Mike's also been active in NAIC, taking the lead on exchanges after Joel left for Washington. He's been a private attorney handling, among other things, insurance-related cases, so we're very pleased to have you with us. Michael?
Great. Thanks, Ed. And, Sarah, thank you to the Alliance for including me today. I arrived in Chicago late last night after spending 5.5 glorious days in Orlando at the NAIC meeting. We were in this giant petri dish of a hotel. There were a couple thousand insurance people in attendance. We have a total of maybe 170 different meetings over the course of those 5 days, ranging from scintillating topics like actuarial analyses on life insurance products to health insurance exchanges. There is not any topic. I've been in this job 5 years, 9 months, not nearly as long as my old friend Joel, but 5 years and 9 months, never has there been any topic that has been the focus of as much attention from the regulatory community as health reform. We finished yesterday calculation or approving a proposal to HHS to calculate medical loss ratios. Talk about that in a second, but I did want to acknowledge Joel and thank Joel and his team, Liz and Chiquita, Barb, the others, and Cindy Mann was there for at least a day, I know, for taking the time to meet with us in the poorly ventilated, dark conference rooms where we discussed important insurance issues for 5.5 days. I know a couple of you were also there and enjoying that electrifying experience with us. But I do want to thank Joel and his team, and because the fact is we need an HHS that is open, clear, but flexible. The exchanges are the culmination of health reform and insurance reform in the country. They are the culmination of the state effort to implement reform. And one of the tensions that we have in the states, in almost every state, is a healthy tension, but the reality is that the states invest the big chunk of their state fiscal expenditures in their Medicaid programs. So as the exchanges are being evaluated, developed, ideas are being considered in the states, the Medicaid programs are clearly a focal point for state government. But for the exchange to work, it is the private plans that will keep the exchange viable and operating. And different states are in different places in terms of their Medicaid programs. And that, to a great extent, accounts for much of the diversity that we see in our work at the NAIC. I did want to acknowledge, before I move on, Kathy Horwood from Congressman Schakowsky's office for her great support to our state as we implement reform. But the medical loss ratio, this was reported by a number of national publications today, and I wanted to discuss that as an entree to the exchange discussion. There was a lot of work done by regulators around the country for the last 6 or 7 months. Some of you, I expect all of you, I'm going to assume all of you are familiar with the MLR. It requires 80% for small groups and individuals, and that an insurer spend 85% of premiums on health care for large groups. Well, that sounds like a simple exercise to those of you who are not insurance regulators, but it has taken months. Just between August and yesterday, the actuarial group, national group of regulators from around the country, had 27 conference calls of at least an hour and spent countless hours in between the conference calls. That's just in the last couple months alone. We considered a lot of alternatives, including alternatives supported by the insurance industry to either make the proposal less effective or more effective, depending on your view. Ultimately, we certified, we proposed and finalized a proposal to HHS to certify yesterday that reflects really the good work of insurance regulators from around the country. It's a balanced, fair, reasonable approach. Reflects that we are trying to do things in a considered and thoughtful manner as we move forward. One of the key issues that has been a constant for us is the role of the producers. Producers is the generic term for agents and brokers. And there is a perception that agents and brokers simply generate commission when they sell a policy and that's all they do. And in fact, that is all some do. But there are many that spend a lot of time helping their clients wrestle with the insurance companies when a claim is not being paid or benefits are not being delivered in a way that the policy expects. That will be a major discussion point for us as state regulators, as we work with HHS going forward, including with Joel and his team. On the exchange, an individual should be able to purchase health insurance within 20 minutes or so, sitting at home wearing a bathrobe. That's a big difference from where we are in many states, including Illinois. It's going to be a big improvement. But small employers in particular are going to still need help, not just in purchasing the product and deciding what's the best product, but how to resolve a dispute with an insurance company. And I can promise you the state insurance departments already handle tens of thousands of, we handle about 40,000 calls a year that turn into about 6,000 or 7,000 actual complaints against insurance companies. The agent community handles many, many more times that. We simply would not have the resources to handle all of those calls. So we need to find a way to accommodate and compensate producers in the improved and evolved health insurance market. So as has been alluded to, we developed a model law that is continuing to be revised. We'll have additional conference calls, we being the NAIC, in the next couple weeks and expect to finalize that for circulation to the states. The point of the effort is to give states that aren't really even sure where to start a template for legislation before their sessions start in January. It doesn't answer all of the questions, including governance. Utah and Massachusetts, for a lot of reasons, are good examples of two ends of the spectrum. Massachusetts, of course, has the independent quasi-state agency. The exchange is operated through the governor's office. Very different. And you can imagine some like the idea of executive branch control over the exchange. Others want to avoid that at all costs. It is fair to say there is a wide disparity or wide divergence around the country as to what approach is best. And each state will make that decision. That is the key threshold challenge for states as they decide how to move forward. Fiscal sustainability, Tim mentioned that. This is a big challenge because as of now, the HHS funding for the exchanges is it 2015? Am I recalling that right? Well, in 2015, we don't expect most states to have a sufficient number of privately insured plans purchased through the exchange for the exchange to be financially dependent upon a fee or assessment imposed on the private insurance industry. These are questions that we'll continue to ask and work through with our colleagues at HHS. Operations of the exchange, Tim mentioned this also, how does an employer contribute to premium on behalf of an employee? As a simple functional matter, how will that work? And if it's not easy enough for an employer and employers look for coverage elsewhere, the exchanges will be challenged to have a sufficient number of covered lives to make the exchange a viable commercial enterprise. Another issue of some sensitivity to the regulators, of course, is whether the exchange is in fact a regulator. So could there theoretically be two regulators for the private health insurance companies who offer products on the exchange? That's a concern for many of us. We have seen in the financial sector where dual regulation also often leads to a form of arbitrage where the company will choose that regulator with the lightest touch. We need to avoid that. As insurance commissioners, we're committed to that. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out in different states. Another interesting question that states are going to ask and answer over the next year or two is whether the exchange should accept all companies that want to sell on the exchange, or should it, in the California model, effectively be a purchaser, issue RFPs asking for companies to bid for the right to sell on the exchange. Again, the challenge is, will the exchange have a sufficient number of covered lives to be attractive to the insurance companies? One way to guarantee a sufficient number of covered lives is to limit the number of companies selling on the exchange through an RFP process. I can foresee, and I think some of my colleagues around the country can foresee, an evolution where perhaps we start as the exchange begins as a purchaser and then moves and evolves to allow more companies as things evolve, as the marketplace evolves and as more policies are sold on the exchange. Last item, adverse selection. Tim mentioned this. Absolutely imperative. If a company can only sell bronze plans off the exchange and companies sell silver and gold on the exchange, there's a significant likelihood of cost difference. Healthy people more likely to pursue the cheaper plan. Sick people more likely interested in a silver or gold plan. That would lead to the adverse selection that could bring about significant adverse selection challenges for an exchange. I do want to commend Tim. His articles, both July and September, are the best articles that I've read about the intersection of the law and the actual functional regulation of insurance and the dynamic of the insurance market and how it can be sustained going forward. But adverse selection is my final thought. The key will be the what are the state laws regulating the sale of plans off the exchange versus those that are sold on the exchange. And this will be not just an issue for state legislatures and governors, but some can anticipate this, you can understand this to be an issue in the November 2nd elections as well. There's a broad polarity, as all of us know, and this is not to be political in any sense, among some candidates in some states about these issues. And if perhaps a governor wins who is not supportive of this effort, it could make implementation that much more difficult, ultimately not benefit consumers in the way that the exchanges are intended to benefit them. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much, Mike. And finally, we're going to hear from Terry Gardner. He's the National Policy Director for the Small Business Majority. That's a relatively new organization that played an active role in the recent reform debate, as many of you know. Terry's a former Alaska state legislator, including service as the Speaker of the House of Representatives. I didn't know that until I pored a little deeply over your biographical sketch. He's also a small business owner, has been a small business owner himself for many years, active in Alaska and other places. So we're pleased to have you with us again, Terry, and let's hear what you have to say.
Thank you. And as sort of the cleanup hitter here, I'm going to try to focus on a narrower band and just deal with small employers, not necessarily the 22 million self-employed, which would go to the individual exchange in an individual market, but focusing in on the people who have employees and how they're going to participate in health reform through the so-called shop exchanges. And I think the first thing to do is, who's the customer, you know, and think about who are these shop exchanges trying to service and attract to make the exchange viable. There's 5.9 million employers with under 100 employees. So it's a big number. And even when you break it out by the 50 states, you're just dealing with large numbers of entities. And they're mostly small. 80% of those have under 10 employees. You know, think you're walking down the street and there's that little restaurant, that bookstore, you know, all those retail shops and other types of businesses. And so the main customer the exchange is going to be servicing is very small. And right today, approximately half of those 80%, over 2 million of those firms are not offering insurance. So they're not very experienced in the insurance world. And I think one of the great opportunities is to, and part of the vision of the legislation with tax credits and other features, is to attract more employment coverage as Massachusetts has done. There's 100,000 more people that work for small businesses that have coverage in Massachusetts post the passage of their system. Most of these small employers do not have HR departments. The person, you know, that's running the business is who has all the titles and hats. They don't have a lot of expertise, and this is one of the reasons that brokers are doing what they're doing with the small group market, is because of this feature. Connecticut, their exchange, where they have 5,400 small businesses, a good example. Their average small business has 8 employees. So that's, you know, what it's going to look like. The other thing to remember is this is going to, the small employers are going to be part of a competitive marketplace with less incentives to come to the exchange than individuals will. They can buy their coverage through the exchange. They could buy it in the outside market. They may want to maintain their grandfather plan status, or they may continue, as many of them are now, not offering health coverage. So you're trying to appeal to quite a diverse group. The tax credit will be, the employer tax credit being offered through the exchange will be one incentive for that group, but that is not, you know, a robust benefit for everyone. It's about, the Lewin study estimated 1.2 million firms would be eligible for the maximum benefit. So I think the question is, you know, that somebody operating the Schaff Exchange should say it to themselves is, you know, what value, what services, you know, what are we going to provide that will incentivize small employers to acquire their insurance here? And another important aspect of starting out, we hold a lot of meetings with small business owners just trying to educate them about health care reform, and just the vast majority of them don't know what the exchange is and how they would participate and how they'd work. So you're starting there. And so I think the states, as they set up the exchanges, need to think a lot about how are they going to reach out to these thousands of small employers in their state and educate them. And, you know, business groups and different media channels are some ways, but half of the small business owners don't belong to any business group. So they may have to use some direct strategy to communicate. And suggested one model here that we know of in Massachusetts, where they set up, before the connector days, a program to cover self-employed fishermen. They had a very successful direct outreach program that they used, very similar to what we're calling navigators in legislation. The other thing that I think would be wise to do is to use some kind of focus group, both of small employers and I think of the brokers that work with small employers, to make sure that the systems and services and all that are going to be understood and are matching up to the needs of small employers. And then this is very vital, the single point of entry, and I think that's been referred to today. It's got to be real simple for these small employers, especially the vast bulk of them, which are really small. And here's a list of features that we think need to be part of that single point of entry for small employers. And I would urge you to go to the Connecticut, the CBIA website, and look at what they offer, because they're really, you know, doing this kind of activities, and they are in that competitive environment. There's no reason small employers have to come to their exchange other than they do a good job and have something to offer of value. And you'll see that they're doing many of these things, and they have figured out how to do the IT parts that were talked about here today, so that it's sort of seamless from both the small employer and their employee picking different plans, and then that money going to all the different insurers. They have 48 different plans that through their system. And insurance brokers, I think what's critical here from some of the case studies we've looked at is you better get it right and launch your exchange and your relationship, whatever it's going to be, with brokers and how they interface with the small employers, which they all have relationships with already. You better do it right. And those who have sort of had to backtrack and try to figure it out when the first stage didn't work out too well, it's been hard to recover. One thing to keep in mind is I think the broker's role is quite different for individuals versus small employers. One of those differences being they're selling a lot of other products to small employers and servicing them on an ongoing basis for those other products. So they're going to be there whatever a state may decide. And I think that the exchange is going to be doing a lot of different functions here, that which each state will decide, and what the level of compensation, that the method of compensation, and what those roles are, you know, need to be rationalized, you know, state by state in a very holistic way. And I think a model that looks pretty good that I've heard a presentation in the state of Washington on, they have a health insurance plan that was a program that was aimed at small employers who currently do not provide coverage. And they have worked with their broker community and the small businesses. They did a lot of focus groups, a lot of back and forth designing their program, and it seems to be getting off the ground with a lot of support in both those communities and having a very smooth reception. And you could want to take a look at their program. It seems to be a good model. Lastly, I just want to mention some other ideas that states ought to look at. Both Utah and Montana have Utah is obviously further down the track. Montana's designing their exchange and their approach of looking at a defined benefits option. And I know I've heard comments from some people that they, you know, worry about where that's going in terms of, I think, existing benefits. But remember, we've got over 2 million small employers not offering insurance. And that would be a good thing if those companies found a way to participate, bring in employer dollars, bring in more of their employees, and a defined benefit system might work for those, because the firms under 50 are not obligated to provide coverage under ACA. Utah has also done an interesting thing where dealing with the whole issue of part-time seasonal employees, where they allow multiple employers to make a contribution towards insurance for that individual, even though they're in the part-time. Because other than Starbucks, you know, most people that have that employ part-time, you know, don't provide coverage. The Wyden Amendment for the Free Choice Voucher, we're interested to see how this works out. It's sort of definitely a pilot program. One estimate was there might be 2 million employees covered by that, so we like to see how that works out and whether that's a way forward for employers and employees. The other thing is, I think states ought to look at discussing the exchanges and engaging large businesses. I think Helen Darling from the National Business Group on Health has made a very compelling case that large businesses and other purchasers of insurance really have a stake in seeing these exchanges, both for the individual and small group, work successfully, because it could help, if they're done right, they could help drive change and costs in the system, which would be beneficial for everybody, including large employers. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. Now you have a chance to get into this conversation. If you, as this gentleman has already taken advantage of, would like to ask a question at the microphone, feel free to do that. We would ask you to keep the question short and direct it to somebody if you can, and identify yourself. And remember the green cards and the blue evaluation form. So let me just say one other thing, and that is, I apologize in advance. My poor planning has put me on a plane that I cannot catch if I stay to the end of this program. So I'm going to leave you in Sarah Collins's capable hands for the bulk of the Q&A. But let me start off by...
Stuart Gordon with AmeriGroup. Two questions for Joel. First one's very short. The essential benefits package, can you remind us what the process is supposed to be for determining that? Is there a survey? Are you doing it? Is labor doing it? Department of Labor. And how's that supposed to be handled? The second, I think the more important question is the transitional insured, the one who might drop in and off of Medicaid, might become eligible, not eligible for the exchange. Does OSIO, do you have the statutory authority to freeze eligibility for somebody who might be right at that 133% federal poverty level? Is there some other method of easing the administrative burden of somebody who might drop on and off? We know the states probably aren't going to want to grant 12-month continuous eligibility under Medicaid. So it would seem like the point of least resistance would be for you all to do something. Do you have the statutory authority to freeze eligibility?
On the first question, there is a set of processes to get to essential benefits, a Department of Labor study, which is due in the spring, and then a referral to the Institute of Medicine, so that is slated for the fall 2011 regulatory cycle rather than the earlier one. On the second question, a number of different approaches to that under consideration. You did reference one, which is the states currently have the option of having continuous enrollment for children. So that is a concept on the Medicaid side that could be looked at, and there are a number of discussions. I think in the larger sphere, I'd point to this as one of the strengths of this law. Most of our states, we've had this big gulf between people who are eligible for Medicaid and oftentimes virtually nothing, and sometimes absolutely nothing for people between that level until they can afford their own coverage. Under this law, we now have some opportunity to have some continuity of care and improve dramatically the health care attention that's given to the population below 400%. But it does raise the issue that you reference, which is what happens if people move back and forth. And we have a number of things under consideration hopefully we'll find some of those ways to make that as smooth as possible.
John Reichard with Congressional Quarterly. I wondered if the panel could comment on how the outlook for exchanges will change with many more Republicans coming into the House, the Senate, and into governor's offices. Don't be shy, please.
So my comments will be nonpartisan, first of all, I do think that some are more inclined to support health reform broadly than others. I think at the state level, we could see rules constructed around the exchange that would, for example, make it more enticing to purchase some plans off the exchange, which could result in adverse selection and higher cost on the exchange. My sense, though, is that the states will want to retain the control over the exchanges. and so that the state can develop an exchange consistent with its own vision, and that that is true regardless of whether it's a Republican or a Democrat in a leadership position.
I'd like to respond a couple of ways to that question. First is the basic idea behind the exchange of managed competition is not a radical left-wing idea. It's an idea that comes out of basically out of free market advocacy groups, and has been endorsed by them in the past. And the particular way in which it's shaped, I think, we'll see some states that red states taking one approach and blue states taking another approach, maybe. I'd guess actually that there's just going to be a range of approaches. But to repeat what Joel said, this is one idea that I haven't seen a huge amount of resistance to in the states. I think that a lot of states think that the market, the non-group and small group market are not working terribly well, and that this might be a good way to improve them. And again, I think the states will take various approaches. I think the statute contemplates that. The NAIC model certainly contemplates that. From everything I've heard from Joel Ario, HHS is open to a wide variety of approaches. So I don't think this is an idea that goes down November 3rd, depending on who wins the most state houses or seats in Congress. So anyway, I think this is a good idea, and it's going to be around.
Yeah, I'll just make a factual observation. I first heard of exchanges from a Republican legislator in Oregon back in 2003 who had a concept paper from Ed Hasselmeyer at the Heritage Foundation. I followed the idea for several years there as it made its way through the Heritage Foundation. They took credit for getting Governor Romney to support the idea in Massachusetts. And to date, the three states that have exchanges have all been led by Republican governors.
Thank you.
Hi, Sarah Cliff with Politico. I was wondering, I guess this is a bit of a follow-up mostly for Mr. Ario. I was wondering if you could speak to how HHS is going to deal with the states that don't decide to run their own exchange. I know Tim brought up the idea that it'd be more difficult to control for things like adverse selection. I've heard some folks suggest the resources might not be there depending on how many states decide they want you all to run their exchanges. So I was wondering kind of what your thought process is in dealing with those states.
I can give a very general answer to that. Again, we start with 48 states and at least one of the other two with a lot of work going on at the state level about the exchange. So we start with a very broad base of interest at the state level, and I hope that continues. There likely will end up being some states that for a variety of reasons, as you referenced, scale and so forth, won't do it, and there we hope the process would be a cooperative one where we would continue to work closely with the state and set up a federal exchange with state cooperation. Something like that came close to happening in Pennsylvania on the high-risk pool where we were going to set up the state high-risk pool. Then there came a set of questions and opposition to it, and there was a discussion with the federal government to do more or less the same kind of exchange, I mean the same kind of risk pool at the federal level, and when the people that were questioning the state pool saw that the same thing was going to happen through a federal high-risk pool, they said, well, maybe it is better to have that at the state level, and that's, in fact, what happened in that case in Pennsylvania. You could see those same kind of dynamics play out. But right now, we're ready to put those federal exchanges up if we need to, and we would hope to do that as in the same kind of cooperative way that we do the state-based exchanges with the states that do their own.
I'd like to supplement that a little bit in this reply. I'm speaking on behalf of the state of Illinois. Our market right now is completely dysfunctional. We have an entirely for-profit market, no approval authority on rate increases. Rate increases don't have to be actuarially justified. People can be denied coverage for any reason other than race, color, religion, or national origin. We lead the country in rescissions by almost 50% over California. We need improvement as of today. Between now and 2014, we've already started to see, by the way, companies more aggressively price and more aggressively underwrite. It is becoming increasingly difficult to deny the reality that the health insurance marketplace needs significant reform. and as we move forward and as companies impose these currently unbridled increases, it's going to be difficult for any elected official to deny the need for the comprehensive reform that we're starting to implement today.
If I could just ask a question myself, I'm wondering if Mike McCraith could say just a word about the white papers that the NAIC is writing. I don't think I heard you talk about those, but I'm also recovering from Orlando, so I might have missed it.
So in addition to drafting the model law for states to consider to introduce in January, which includes the baseline expectations of the federal law, we're also providing to the states a series of issue briefs or brief white papers on topics ranging from competition to governance to fiscal sustainability, operations, regulatory function. We expect to have those completed within the next 6 to 8 weeks. And if some of you are from congressional staffs and the one thing I'd encourage you to embrace as a reality is that every state insurance market is different. The Massachusetts market is very different from the Utah market. Illinois is very different from Minnesota. These are realities. So as we talk in broad terms, understand there's a lot of nuance, real idiosyncrasy to each state. The white papers are intended to provide guidance and broad principles for all of the policymakers in the states to consider.
Thanks, Tim.
I had a question for Tim or a comment after reading your 8 kind of issues paper, and it was around governance, this very important front-end question. And as you kind of went through the analysis, you focused very much on conflicts or potential conflicts of interest, the different types of people, doctors or agents, certainly health insurers would have, that would keep them from being able to be part of, it seemed, the governance structure of a board. In a state like where I come from, North Carolina, I get the feeling that there needs to be a sense that those folks have a place at the table and that the focus is less on eliminating conflicts and on managing conflicts somehow so that we can take advantage of, after all, the expertise that they would have in helping to run these things. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. One is that there is provision for an advisory board or for at least consultation of stakeholders, and I really think that's the appropriate place for people to be with conflicts rather than having a seat at the table in governing the exchange itself. Secondly, I was had the privilege of serving for a couple of years on a Institute of Medicine committee on conflicts of interest in medicine, and we heard an awful lot about managing conflicts as opposed to eliminating conflicts. And I think at the end of the day, a lot of us felt that it makes more sense to eliminate conflicts whenever possible than to try to manage them, because managing becomes very, very difficult. And I really think that the exchange itself should be governed by a body whose sole interest is the interests of the exchange and who does not have any conflicting interests, and that then there should be a robust advisory process where you turn to people who do have obviously a lot of knowledge of the situation on the ground to give you advice as opposed to making governing decisions.
So I'm going to go to the some of the submitted questions. First, this question is for Mike McRaith and everyone on the panel. Could you elaborate on the coordination challenges between the exchange and Medicaid CHIP? Specifically, there is an option for states to transition CHIP plans to the exchange. Have you thought about challenges, opportunities for this transition? And I wonder, too, if it matters, if the governance issue, whether that matters as well, whether quasi-government entities will be able to handle this differently or better, easier than nonprofit.
In terms of governance and the relationship with Medicaid versus private plans, some states are considering operating their exchanges through a Department of Insurance or an executive branch agency. As discussed, Utah operates its exchange through the governor's office. So as we contemplate a definition of conflicts, it depends how broadly we want to interpret that word when we think about conflicts. And clearly, though, an exchange that's run through a Department of Insurance is going to have a different view of public health programs or Medicaid programs than an independent exchange that is not necessarily wed to the regulation of insurance or the private market. I would, in terms of the, again, I think I characterized it, or I hope I did, as characterized it as a healthy tension within state governments because of the fiscal commitment of states to Medicaid programs. Single biggest item in any state budget is the Medicaid budget. But for the exchange to work, it has to have sufficient number of covered lives, also privately covered lives. What I hear from other states and certainly experience in Illinois is this is viewed as an opportunity by many programs. Joel, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. Many state Medicaid programs to update information technology to bring it into the 21st century. In Illinois, we have this, we have generations of hamster family that have, that spin on these wheels that generate the energy to run the enrollment program. And so we have challenges in our IT system, and we're not alone. And so I think a lot of states are viewing the exchange as an opportunity to add efficiency to the enrollment, to the eligibility determinations, and ultimately what we want to see at the state level is an improvement in the quality of care as we have the health information technology as well as the health coverage technology. And that's a whole other topic that we can talk about later on in a couple of years maybe, but the intersection of those two and how that's going to provide better outcomes in the Medicaid population in particular.
Again, I mentioned that we're looking at IT guidance around the exchanges. When we do that, we're likely to also couple that with IT guidance around the Medicaid issues because, as Mike said, they're intertwined. The other observation I'd make on this point is that we've heard from many of the larger Medicaid programs around the country having Medicaid provider programs or plans, insurer-type plans on the Medicaid side. Some of the private insurers already are active in the Medicaid space. United has a very strong subsidiary in that space. But a lot of them, there's a lot of gulf between who plays in Medicaid, who plays in the commercial market. At least from the Medicaid side, there's an interest in potentially moving over the line and being on the commercial side of that ledger. And that's another way to deal with the question that was first asked here about continuity of care between Medicaid and the commercial space.
Thank you. Another question?
Hi, Kathy Hurwitt with Congresswoman Janczkowski. Thanks for doing this. This is a great session. I've been in several meetings this week where we've been talking about adverse selection issues in terms of network adequacy. Those discussions have been around accountable care organizations. But I'm wondering whether you think we need to be looking at network adequacy issues within the exchange in terms of adverse selection, and if so, how we should be doing it.
Yes.
How to?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think one of the requirements for being a certified health plan is there are some requirements with respect to networks, and network, how you form your networks is obviously a way to do adverse selection. If you don't have anybody in your network who can care for diabetes, you won't have any diabetics. I mean, that's sort of an extreme example, but you could certainly think of some subspecialties where you could avoid them and avoid some very costly care. That's something I think that as exchanges form, they're going to have some standards in that, and they're going to have to work on that. That'll probably be a problem in terms of selection within the exchange as well as selection between the exchange and outside the exchange.
Kathy, just to supplement that, as you might know, departments of insurance right now review networks that are offered in the state in conjunction with a health plan and verify the adequacy of the network. However, the relationships between providers and payers is an area of fertile area for conflict and increasing conflict. And we see in the Medicaid programs, for example, the lower reimbursement rates are driving some providers out of Medicaid networks, at least in states like Illinois. We also see some specialists refusing to join networks. It's a big national problem, what we call ancillary providers, providers like anesthesiologists, for example. If I go in to have knee surgery, I get certified, approved by my health insurance company, go through the whole thing, and as I'm on the gurney practically, some guy walks up and says, oh, sign this, by the way. Of course, people sign this because they're on their way into the operating room, only to find out that they've agreed to pay the anesthesiologist independently of the insurance plan. That's a problem that's increasingly prevalent around the country. Having said that, as the insurance market, private plan market is going to be very different, in my view, interested in Jill's thoughts again on this, in 2 years than what we have right now. We are going to see states like Illinois developing co-ops, much like we have in Wisconsin and Minnesota. We are going to see more accountable care organizations, and we're going to see heightened regulation on the relationships between the providers and the payers.
Yeah, I think this is a very complex area. There's certainly an obvious point which Tim made, which is that if you have narrow networks, you're going to drive selection issues, and there is language in the Affordable Care Law about that, and including language about essential community providers and so forth. The less obvious point, though, is if we're talking about payment reform and cost control here, that you certainly hear from the Accountable Care Organization side that certain kinds of requirements about networks get in the way of managing care effectively and dealing with delivery reform. So this problem has multi dimensions.
My name is Tamara Zeidenweber. I work with the DC Department of Healthcare Finance. We're the agency responsible here for implementing the exchange. One of the many issues we have come across is the issue of purchasing across state lines, where many Maryland and Virginia residents, for example, could purchase insurance through our exchange, you know, as an employee of a district, firm. I'm wondering if any of you could comment on that.
So, very briefly, it's an issue that, as states, we talked about, and I don't know if you were there, Joel, when we were talking about that this week. It's a big concern for many states. You can think of people. Southern Illinois, which, by the way, is closer to Mobile, Alabama than Chicago, just across the border from Paducah, Kentucky, those people will often go to across the border to get their health care. That's true on all borders of most states. So, and in fact, South Dakota and North Dakota, we had this conversation, they also are interested in that. So what we are talking about, and this is kind of phase two of our efforts at the NEIC, is how do we flesh out the regional exchanges to accommodate those people who need care across borders.
I have a somewhat related question to that, and that's on the state compacts that states are allowed to make under the law. And the question is, if states actually do the state compacts, how would these interface with the exchanges?
There is allowance in the law for these different mechanisms, and one thing I have been surprised at is the amount of interest in potentially regional exchanges and then maybe some compacts underneath them and so forth or to support them. I think the initiative for that will have to come from the states. The law doesn't really provide much guidance on that process, but it does allow the states to come together. And you, I think the places where you see that most often discussed is kind of the spine of the West, where there's a number of states with, you know, fairly sparse populations and fairly spread out populations and some real problems with scale. So you hear the discussion there, but then there, you can look to other parts of the country where there may be more similarities between the ways the markets are already regulated. Like northern New England tends to have a lot of commonality around the way it way those states regulate insurance. Southern states have some commonalities as well. So that those discussions are ongoing, but that whole issue of how do you bridge a number of different kind of gaps of authority between the states. In my years at the NAIC, we never really came to any good solutions. I'm sure Mike and the crew now have a much better chance, but they're challenging issues.
Just a couple more thoughts on that. One is, I guess I was surprised, too, how much more interest I'm hearing in regional exchanges than I thought I was hearing a couple of months ago. And also, I think that there might be different perspectives within the state, that there might be some political leaders within a state, particularly smaller states, who think those sound pretty interesting, and there might be some insurance commissioners who get really concerned about how are we going to coordinate regulation of different insurance markets across states. The other thing, though, that hasn't been mentioned is the multi-state exchanges, multi-state plans. And, of course, OPM is supposed to come up with a couple of those, and they're supposed to fairly quickly be up to speed for operating in all states. So if you do have a situation where, for example, you have employees in an exchange who live in a state, well, if they're purchasing through their employer who is in one state and they live in another state across the river, they might want to look seriously at a multi-state plan that would have a presence in all states.
And one addendum is that, and this is a little bit of editorial, but don't presume that those types of arrangements will provide economic benefit to purchasers. The presumption, remember why a Humana, and just take in any company, in Alabama, say company ABC, Alabama plan is cheaper than an ABC plan in Illinois, has a lot to do with reimbursement rates and a lot to do with benefits, mandated benefit coverages. Alabama, the state does not cover osteoporosis screening and treatment, doesn't have a benefit, autism benefit for children like the laws in Illinois do. So there are cost differences that result from that. Do not expect that the state legislature in Illinois is going to accept a plan that doesn't cover those basics, or that somehow a plan is going to impose lower reimbursement rates just because it's from another state.
Another option that states have is the basic health plan. And so the question is, what do you think are the strengths and limitations of the basic health plan fitting in between the Medicaid program and the exchanges? And are you hearing much from states about actually taking up this option?
I'd say that's one I'm surprised on the other side. I have not had those discussions yet. Doesn't mean they're not going on, but they have not crossed my desk.
Do you have a question?
Yeah. Rachel Klein with Families USA. And on to the question about regional plans, one of the things I've been trying to figure out is how a regional plan would make sure that people, when they apply, who are eligible for Medicaid, are appropriately screened and enrolled in a state Medicaid program if they have a regional exchange that's operating in multiple states. I don't know if any of you have given any thought to that issue. But the other question I have actually goes back to the issue about the application process in a regular state exchange. One of the things we're really concerned about is making sure that that's a very easy process for consumers, and that when they apply, they are able to get into Medicaid or CHIP or an exchange plan quickly and easily. And it's already been raised that this is a particular issue for state IT programs, and there's a lot of improvement that needs to happen in state IT in order to make sure that this happens. And Mr. Ayu mentioned that there is some forthcoming guidance from HHS and possibly even some development of some technology. And I wonder if you'd be able to say a little bit more about what HHS is thinking about in that and when we might hear more about it.
I can't really say more than I already said. It's definitely an issue that we're pursuing. On your other issue with Medicaid, today in the Medicaid world, there are more challenges because the program is, it's called categorical eligibility. You fit into this pigeonhole or that pigeonhole or this pigeonhole. And under the new law, more or less, it's an income base, 133%. Everybody's eligible up to that income level. So we listen to Cindy Mann these days, and that was what she was down talking to the NEIC about, is it's a new day in Medicaid, too. As she says, it's not your grandma or grandfather's Medicaid program anymore, and that means that the states are going to have more similarities around how Medicaid operates than they may have in the past, and so there are more opportunities. But the other thing I'll say about the regional issue is that most of the times, as I listen to the discussion and it kind of progresses, it tends to move away from, like, let's combine our states on every function and have a completely integrated, full-scale regional exchange, and more like, well, there's maybe 10 functions that we're doing, and maybe three of them the federal government's kind of helping us with, and maybe six of them we should, or five of them we should combine somehow, and a couple of them, you know, are going to be unique to our state. So it's more of a menu and pick and choose how you might integrate specific things. Even then, I think it's a challenge because of the way markets, I think several people have set up here, markets operate locally in healthcare, and so it's still a challenge. But people are looking at it more seriously than I expected when I took this job.
Just to follow up on that briefly, I'm also working with the National Academy of Social Insurance, which is drafting some model legislation to sort of supplement the NAIC legislation. And that is an issue we recently spent some time talking about, is it's not, you know, just imagining how do you move from the scale of the state to the region, but how do you move from the scale of the state to the insurer, because particularly, you know, small HMOs are not going to be statewide. Many insurers are not going to be statewide. And so the exchange, whether it's at the state level or the regional level, is also going to have a local interface, so that if you have an HMO that only covers one county, you can sign people up for that HMO.
I have a question on the financing of the exchanges going forward, and how much you started your planning grant process. So the question is, how much more financing will there be available for states as this moves forward over the next few years?
As the statute says, the necessary expenses to stand up an exchange. And think about it this way: if the state chooses not to stand one up, the federal government does have to stand one up. So either way, federal government's on the hook to pay for the necessary expenses to stand one up. Again, there's the language about meeting the secretary's benchmark. So this is an accountable process, but we're on the hook as a federal government until the exchanges are stood up in 2014. And then the problem becomes the exchange's problem or the state's problem from that point forward.
Another question. This is a broader market question about trends that are happening right now. There have been many reports about rising costs of insurance premiums. Right now, in Connecticut, the 47% increase in Anthem in Connecticut. Could you comment on why this is happening, and what are the departments of insurance doing about it, and how will the exchanges fix this problem?
As I mentioned, Illinois does not have, as a function of state law, the authority to approve or deny rate increases. Many states do. I think it's 30 states now have the authority to approve or deny rate increases. In states that do not, like Illinois, we are seeing, I don't know if I used the word explosive or unbridled, but they are both descriptive of the premium increases we're seeing. One reason for that is because they can. Another reason why we see that even in states like Connecticut that do have rate approval authority, and by the way, I think Commissioner Sullivan is very responsible in his implementation and enforcement of their state law, but is that the premium increases are tied to the health status of the covered individuals. So there might be premium increases for plans that are justifiably high in our current world. As we move forward and remove health status as an underwriting and rating consideration, we won't see the same volatility that we experience now. As we remove health status, we cannot attribute the increases to one person in a small employer group to having one or two people who have an illness during the course of a year. We'll see much greater stability in our premiums going forward. But right now, states do what they can. Not every state can do much. And the insurance companies, as smart business people, take full advantage of what the law provides.
To remember, there's a separate provision in the statute for justification of unreasonable premium increases, and that has not yet been fully implemented, but it was supposed to, I believe it's effective immediately upon the enactment of the statute, so it should be in place pretty soon. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners has been working on a form that was approved by their Speed to Market Committee at the meeting in Orlando to be used by insurers who want to justify an unreasonable rate increase. HHS has not asked the NAIC, fortunately, to decide what an unreasonable premium increase is. They're apparently going to do that themselves. The form is pretty impressive, I think. It requires a great deal of information that is going to become public, that insurers are going to have to provide to explain why they are asking for an unreasonable rate increase. And so even in states that don't have rate review authority, that information is going to be up there, including one thing I like is the per member per month expense for the salaries of the top 10 highest paid officials in the company. There's a lot of other information on there as well. And then secondly, the federal government has been giving out grants to the states, I believe to 46 states, for funding rate review. And so I think some states that don't have it now may think that it might be worth doing to continue to get the federal money for it. So I'm hoping that, and I wonder to some extent whether the explosion in premium increases right now is not in part due to the fact that the insurers know that the party's soon over.
This is something we certainly hear about in our meetings with small business owners around the country, and a typical comment that actually came from a small business owner who was a Republican state legislator said, you know, my premium went up 37%. And of course, that's not the average, but, you know, one of the, I think it's the burden is disproportionately falling on the smallest employers because they have the least leverage, and that's where insurance companies, if they want to, you know, generate more revenues, have the easiest time with somebody that can't really fight back. And so it's out there, and I think this is intersects with the questions earlier about, you know, the politics of health reform overall and how that's going to change. I mean, this is beneath the surface driving, you know, while the headlines are focusing on other issues, employers and their employees are experiencing at the ground level each year as we progress towards implementing these very volatile and many times significant rate increases. And, you know, and I think that's going to be a counter force when people talk about rolling this thing back.
Yeah, just to follow up a little bit, what we are seeing are some completely unjustified rate increases. One company attempted to increase its rates 84%, attributing that to the reforms that were effective September 23rd, and of course the net cost impact of those is less than 1%. And our estimates are that it's much closer than to 0.5%. But there are some, including me, who do perceive the underwriting and rating to be more aggressive now than it has ever been, because as we approach 2014, when every person who applies is to be covered, the for-profit companies would prefer starting with a healthier book of policyholders.
I think we have time for one more question.
Okay. My name is Larry Berman. I am a healthcare consultant here in D.C. I used to be executive director of the D.C. Insurance Federation. My question is, how do you see the evolving role or the relationship between the exchanges and the insurance departments of the respective states it appears that the exchanges are really taking over a lot of the functions of what you would expect the insurance departments to do, even including the issues of network adequacy. In some states, some jurisdictions like D.C., the healthcare finance department seems to be taking the lead. But do you see a conflict? Who's going to be licensing and regulating insurance? Is that role now going to be moved over to the exchange, or will it remain with the state insurance department? Thank you.
We talked earlier about that continuum from an open marketplace that you basically say any insurer who meets minimum standards comes into the exchange versus an exchange that operates more like a large employer and says I'm going to have some selective contracting, some bidding maybe, and try to drive price and quality with my market leverage. If you're on the first end of that continuum, then I think the model of an insurance company and the exchange operates closer to like an insurance company. You could imagine it being within the insurance department because you're basically saying anybody who meets the minimum standards gets in. That's more akin to what insurance regulators do today. The more you move to that selective contracting market, that's not akin to what insurance regulators do, so the functions are quite different in the second case. And I think for the foreseeable future anyway, likely even in the first case, that the exchange will have additional duties that will distinguish it from general insurance regulation.
I don't agree with the premise of your question, but I do appreciate the direction. It doesn't make sense to have two different agencies or one quasi-agency and an agency regulating the same companies. It simply is not in anyone's interest. Our expectation in most states, and this just reiterates what Joel said, is that the exchange will supervise the plans and determine continuing eligibility of those plans to be sold on the exchange. However, it's the Department of Insurance that will continue to have the authority to regulate and enforce those standards in the event a plan fails to meet them.
With that, I think that we're at the end of our time here. I really want to very much thank the panelists, Joel Ario, Michael McRaith, Tim Jost, and Terry Gardner for their not only their work today, but their ongoing work on the exchanges. It's just been just tremendous. And I want to remind you. I also want to remind you to fill out your blue evaluation forms. And there are several questions that we didn't get to today, and we'll post those online. So thank you.
Terry. I suppose on the phone.
Yeah. So you're working on that. I'm on the bill with the. Yeah. Anyway.